good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go riding.
You're listening to episode 646 of Unwelcome Guests. Much is learned by being lazy. I am Robin Upton, and that title is a quote from John Taylor Gatto's Underground History of American Education. Today's episode is dedicated to Tom, to whom I'm very grateful, and to the universe for sending Tom my way as an antidote to so many well-meaning elders and betters determined to teach me the value of hard work, something that I quite understand. I've spent years of my life not only recovering as far as information goes, relearning things which I picked up a rather twisted perspective on in mass compulsion schooling, but trying to correct for attitudes, very keen through my academic career to please authority. Possibly how I managed to get as far as PhD level, by trying hard to do the things I've been told to do, without enough reflection on whether they needed to be done, or whether they needed to be done in the way that I was doing them. So, thanks to Tom for teaching me the value of being lazy. I've got a reflective, slow-paced show for you this week. I know a lot of you listen to Unwelcome Guests as you're driving or while you're doing other things. Well, I've got to warn you, this week's show is perhaps a rather deceptive one. Seems like you could concentrate on something else and just let it flow in. Well, you can do that, but be prepared to listen to it a couple of times at least in order to really understand what it's about, because I've listened to these recordings several times, and I keep learning new things from them and from the connections between the different speakers. I'm going to begin with what I think is the most straightforward and accessible material I've got for you this week. This is Professor Anne Woodleaf giving us a helpful introduction to the reading of Walden, which picks up where we left off last week.
I'd like to talk about Henry David Thoreau's Walden, my favorite work. Walden is a very special book in a certain way. It creates a relationship between the reader and writer that you don't find in very many works. It's not necessarily a good relationship. Sometimes it can be rather rocky. Some people read Walden and they don't like Thoreau. Others become disciples. In fact, on the first reading in particular, it's very hard to give a kind of an objective analysis of it. What exactly is this kind of relationship between reader and writer? What is he doing with this? So I'd like to talk about it from this sort of rhetorical point of view, just what exactly is happening and why. And I'd like to describe it in terms of a metaphor. Thoreau was pretty good at taking metaphors and turning them upside down, and I'd like to do a little bit of that. I'd like to think about Walden as a kind of transcendental striptease. Now, transcendental may be the easiest word for you on this one. Transcendental, you should have some idea what it means if you read your Emerson. Simply, very simply, I suppose, you could call it going beyond the fact to the idea. Looking beyond nature, perhaps, and usually, for some sort of embedded ideas, spiritual truths, or whatever. For Thoreau, it was also not just looking beyond, but maybe looking through the facts of nature. As he said, he wanted to see the facts blossom into truths. So he starts with something very concrete and goes from that to something very abstract, perhaps even intellectual, spiritual. So it is transcendental what he is doing in Walden is very transcendental, because he is in nature. He is looking at the facts of his life, at the facts of nature, and he is trying to look through them. All right, maybe you understand transcendental, but striptease? Thoreau probably seems like one of the least sexual writers you've ever run across in literature. Well, we'll leave that one for a minute. But let's do the kind of thing to the word striptease that he did. Let's look at each word very carefully and consider all the possible meanings it might have beside the usual one. Strip, for starters. Thoreau does strip in Walden. He strips himself down to the absolute necessaries of life, as he calls them. Food, heat, shelter, and clothing. He just determines what would be the most basic things that he absolutely needs to live. Ah, there's a key word, to live. Why is he stripping down? He's stripping down more than just literally, though. He's also stripping down the expectations, the assumptions, the traditions, all the other things that people think he ought to be that just don't seem to work for him, and in fact don't seem to work for very many other people either. He wants to live life on its most basic terms. He wants not to be so, have his time caught up with doing things to make money so that he forgets and is unable to live. He wants to do what's important to him, not what other people think should be important. So he does, in fact, do a kind of literal strip for us in the beginning of Walden. In the same way, he causes the reader to undergo a kind of a stripping process too, at least he tries. Because as he is stripping himself, he's criticizing society, they, for not, for having such strange values, for doing so many things that actually in the end rob them of their lives, of the most meaningful parts of their lives. So he is, as he is criticizing them, though, you as a reader often become very uncomfortable as you realize he's not only criticizing them, but you are one of them. You are one of those people who thinks clothes are important, for example. Now, clothes here, there's another good example of the concrete, which is also means more. He is talking about literally clothes, but he is also talking about the baggage that we wear of what other people think, of assumptions that we have never looked at very carefully. Another way in which he strips is that he strips language. He looks at words that we're all used to using, and he strips them down to what they might really mean. He talks a lot about economy, for example, but it doesn't have anything much to do with economy as most of us would look at it. He's talking about how to live life most economically. In other words, how to not spend your time doing things that are not important to you, not important to what it really makes, what really means for you to live. He also redefines a lot of words. He uses paradoxes, for example. He talks about how voluntary poverty can be the greatest wealth. That's strange. Or how the savage might be far more civilized than we are. Again, these kinds of ideas make us stop and look at language and look at the ideas that are around us. He turns our world upside down in certain ways. So he is bringing us into this process of stripping. True, we're probably not going to build a hut by a pond, but we are paying attention to the idea that we need to look at our assumptions, look at why we are living, and see if this is really... is this really how we want to spend our time? He certainly decided he didn't want to spend his time that way. Maybe we don't either. So this is part of what happens, is he strips, and it is a kind of an exhibition. As this eye goes through in building his house, we too are encouraged to look carefully at our lives and see if we are leading lives of quiet desperation. And if we are, what can we do to change them? Then comes the tease part. Anybody who doesn't realize that Thoreau has a great sense of humor is missing much of the book. He does tease his readers. He makes jokes. He makes plays on words. He teases in other ways, too. He doesn't say what he means often. You can read sentences, sometimes whole paragraphs, and when you finish, you say, "What did he say?" I promise you that does get easier with rereadings, but he does write these sentences that are very puzzling, and it seems like he is teasing you. He's not saying what it is that he's meaning. But that does also bring you into the book in a certain way. It demands a kind of an attention, because without it, you can't begin to understand what it is that he's saying. You've got to pay attention, because he's giving you hints, but he's not always telling the whole story. You have to figure what that is. There are other ways in which teasing is important, too. He's teasing the facts of nature. He's trying to tease the truths out of them. It's not a one-to-one relationship between what he observes in nature and the kind of truth that he sees embedded. As a matter of fact, I think he believes that there are many truths that can be embedded in the fact, whatever fact it is that he's looking at, and that those truths may be different for his reader than they are for him. So he teases out hints, suggestions, ideas, when he's talking about things like the pond or the bugs or the ants or the loon or beans or whatever fact that he's looking at very closely. It's not a one-to-one kind of a relationship. There are ideas, but you have to work hard to find out what they are. And in fact, he believes that that is the nature of truth. It is very well hidden, and it shows itself only by indirection and hints. So there's another kind of tease going on there, too. Another thing happens, too, as we get into where I lived and what I live for, and past that part of the book. And suddenly you become, as a reader, you are no longer you, you're no longer one of they, but you become a kind of a partner, a we. As he explores through nature and through his experience, you do too. You become, no longer is he challenging you with questions and ideas, but you just sort of are there with him as he is going through his experiences, and you are experiencing them with him. You are more of a partner than an antagonist. So what's the object of this striptease? The object, I think, is to bring the reader into this world, to make the reader also think about ways in which he might want to strip down his life to the basics, to the essentials, and then how to figure out how to reconstruct his life. Thoreau reconstructs his life in one way. In fact, he's reconstructing it all the way through Walden. You might reconstruct yours in another. That's why you have to take hints, because you're going to see nature, you're going to read these truths perhaps differently from the way he is. It's very frustrating in reading it because it seems so open-ended, but that is at the same time its strength. You make it what you want. So if the book works as he intended, and for many readers it does, he draws you into his world through his striptease and makes you, in fact, a performer in your own world so that you can reconstruct your own world, having decided by stripping that there are problems with the world that you presently live in. So it doesn't leave the reader as quite the same person he or she was when he began the work. At least that is the object of this transcendental striptease.
By closing the eyes and slumbering, and consenting to be deceived by shows, men establish and confirm their daily life of routine and habit everywhere, which still is built on purely illusory foundations. Children who play life discern its true law and relations more clearly than men who fail to live it worthily, but who think that they are wiser by experience, that is, by failure. I have read in a Hindu book that, quote, "There was a king's son who, being expelled in infancy from his native city, was brought up by a forester, and growing up to maturity in that state, imagined himself to belong to the barbarous race with which he lived. One of his father's ministers, having discovered him, revealed to him what he was, and the misconception of his character was removed, and he knew himself to be a prince. So soul, end quote, continues the Hindu philosopher, quote, from the circumstances in which it is placed, mistakes its own character until the truth is revealed to it by some holy teacher, and then it knows itself to be Brahman. End quote. I perceive that we inhabitants of New England live this mean life that we do because our vision does not penetrate the surface of things. We think that that is which appears to be. If a man should walk through this town and see only the reality, where, think you, would the mill dam go to? If he should give us an account of the realities he beheld there, we should not recognize the place in his description. Look at a meeting house, or a courthouse, or a jail, or a shop, or a dwelling house, and say what that thing really is before a true gaze, and they would all go to pieces in your account of them. Men esteem truth remote, in the outskirts of the system, behind the farthest star, before Adam, and after the last man. In eternity, there is indeed something true and sublime. But all these times and places and occasions are now and here. God himself culminates in the present moment and will never be more divine in the lapse of all the ages. And we are enabled to apprehend at all what is sublime and noble only by the perpetual instilling and wrenching of the reality that surrounds us. The universe constantly and obediently answers to our conceptions. Whether we travel fast or slow, the track is laid for us. Let us spend our lives in conceiving, then. The poet or the artist never yet had so fair and noble a design, but some of his posterity at least could accomplish it. Let us spend one day as deliberately as nature, and not be thrown off the track by every nutshell and mosquito's wing that falls on the rails. Let us rise early and fast, or break fast gently and without perturbation. Let company come and let company go. Let the bells ring and the children cry, determined to make a day of it. Why should we knock under and go with the stream? Let us not be upset and overwhelmed in that terrible, rapid, and whirlpool called a dinner, situated in the meridian shallows. Weather this danger and you are safe, for the rest of the way is downhill. With unrelaxed nerves, with morning vigor, sail by it, looking another way, tied to the mast like Ulysses. If the engine whistles, let it whistle till it is hoarse for its pains. If the bell rings, why should we run? We will consider what kind of music they are like. Let us settle ourselves and work and wedge our feet downward through the mud and slush of opinion and prejudice and tradition and delusion and appearance, that alluvion which covers the globe through Paris and London, through New York and Boston and Concord, through church and state, through poetry and philosophy and religion, till we come to a hard bottom and rocks in place, which we can call reality, and say, this is, and no mistake. And then begin, having a point d'appui, below freshet and frost and fire, a place where you might found a wall or a state, or set a lamp-post safely, or perhaps a gauge, not a nilometer, but a realometer, that future ages might know how deep a freshet of shams and appearances had gathered from time to time. If you stand right fronting and face to face to a fact, you will see the sun glimmer on both its surfaces as if it were a scimitar, and feel its sweet edge dividing you through the heart and marrow, and so you will happily conclude your mortal career, be it life or death. We crave only reality. If we are really dying, let us hear the rattle in our throats and feel cold in the extremities. If we are alive, let us go about our business. Time is but the stream I go a-fishing in. I drink at it, but while I drink, I see the sandy bottom and detect how shallow it is. Its thin current slides away, but eternity remains. I would drink deeper, fish in the sky, whose bottom is pebbly with stars. I cannot count one. I know not the first letter of the alphabet. I have always been regretting that I was not as wise as the day I was born. The intellect is a cleaver. It discerns and rifts its way into the secret of things. I do not wish to be any more busy with my hands than is necessary. My head is hands and feet. I feel all my best faculties concentrated in it. My instinct tells me that my head is an organ for burrowing, as some creatures use their snout and forepaws, and with it I would mine and burrow my way through these hills. I think that the richest vein is somewhere hereabouts. So by the divining rod and thin rising vapors I judge. And here I will begin to mine.
Now, with that earnest admonition to concentration still ringing in our ears, let's hear perhaps the most densely packed material I have for you this week. This is a reading from chapter 4 of Wendell Berry's culture and agriculture.
The Unsettling of America, Culture and Agriculture by Wendell Berry. Chapter 4, The Agricultural Crisis as a Crisis of Culture. In my boyhood, Henry County, Kentucky, was not just a rural county, as it still is. It was a farming county. The farms were generally small. They were farmed by families who lived not only upon them, but within and from them. These families grew gardens. They produced their own meat, milk, and eggs. The farms were highly diversified. The main money crop was tobacco, but the farmers also grew corn, wheat, barley, oats, hay, and sorghum. Cattle, hogs, and sheep were all characteristically raised on the same farms. There were small dairies, the milking more often than not done by hand. Those were the farm products that might have been considered major, but there were also minor products, and one of the most important characteristics of that old economy was the existence of markets for minor products. In those days, a farm family could easily market its surplus cream, eggs, old hens, and frying chickens. The power for fieldwork was still furnished mainly by horses and mules. There was still a prevalent pride in workmanship, and thrift was still a forceful social ideal. The pride of most people was still in their homes, and their homes looked like it. This was by no means a perfect society. Its people had often been violent and wasteful in their use of the land and of each other. Its present ills had already taken root in it. But I have spoken of its agricultural economy of a generation ago to suggest that there were also good qualities indigenous to it that might have been cultivated and built upon. That they were not cultivated and built upon, that they were repudiated as the stuff of hopelessly outmoded, unscientific way of life, is a tragic error on the part of the people themselves, and is a work of monstrous ignorance and irresponsibility on the part of experts and politicians, who have prescribed, encouraged, and applauded the disintegration of such farming communities all over the country. In the decades since World War II, the farms of Henry County have become increasingly mechanized. Though they are still comparatively diversified, they are less diversified than they used to be. The holdings are larger, the owners are fewer, the land is falling more and more into the hands of speculators and professional people from the cities, who, in spite of all the scientific agricultural miracles, still have more money than the farmers. Because of big technology and big economics, there is more abandoned land in the county than ever before. Many of the better farms are visibly deteriorating for want of manpower and time and money to maintain them properly. The number of part-time farmers and ex-farmers increases every year. Our harvests depend more and more on the labor of old people and young children. The farm people live less and less from their own produce and more from what they buy. The best of them are more worried about money and more overworked than ever before. Among the people as a whole, the focus of interest has largely shifted from the household to the automobile. The ideals of workmanship and thrift have been replaced by the goals of leisure, comfort, and entertainment. For Henry County plays its full part in what Maurice Tallien called the world's most broad-based hedonism. The young people expect to leave as soon as they finish high school, and so they are without permanent interest. They are generally not interested in anything that cannot be reached by automobile on good road. Few of the farmer's children will be able to afford to stay on the farm. Perhaps even fewer will wish to do so, for it will cost too much, require too much work and worry, and it's hardly a fashionable ambition. Nowhere now is there a market for minor produce. A bucket of cream, a hen, a few dozen eggs. One cannot sell milk from a few cows anymore. The law-required equipment is too expensive. Those markets were done away with in the name of sanitation, but of course, to the enrichment of the large producers. We have always had to have a good reason for doing away with small operators, and in the modern times the good reason has often been sanitation, for which there is apparently no small or cheap technology. Future historians will no doubt remark upon the inevitable association with us between sanitation and filthy lucre. And it is one of the miracles of science and hygiene that the germs that used to be in our food have been replaced by poisons. In all this, few people whose testimony would have mattered have seen the connection between the modernization of agricultural techniques and the disintegration of the culture and the communities of farming, and the consequent disintegration of the structures of urban life. What we have called agricultural progress has, in fact, involved the forceful displacement of millions of people. I remember during the 50s, the outrage with which our political leaders spoke of the forced removal of the populations of villages in communist countries. I also remember that at the same time, in Washington, the word on farming was, get big or get out. A policy which is still in effect and which has taken an enormous toll. The only difference is that of method. The force used by communists was military. With us, it has been economic, a free market, in which the freest were the richest. The attitudes are equally cruel, and I believe that the results will prove equally damaging, not just to the concerns and values of the human spirit, but to the practicalities of survival. And so those who could not get big have got out, not just in my community, but in farm communities all over the country. But as a social or economic goal, bigness is totalitarian. It establishes an inevitable tendencies toward the one that got the biggest of all. Many who got big to stay in are now being driven out by those who got bigger. The aim of bigness implies not one aim that is not socially and culturally And this community-killing agriculture, with its monomania of bigness, is not primarily the work of farmers, though it is burgeoned on their weaknesses, is the work of the institutions of agriculture, the university experts, the bureaucrats, and the agribusinessmen, who have promoted so-called efficiency at the expense of community, and of real efficiency, and quantity at the expense of quality. In 1973, 1,000 Kentucky dairies went out of business. They were the victims of policies by which we imported dairy products to compete with our own and exported so much grain as to cause a drastic rise in the price of feed. And typically, an agriculture expert at the University of Kentucky, Dr. John Nicolai, was optimistic about the failure of these 1,000 dairymen, whose cause he is supposedly being paid, partly with their tax money, to serve. They were inefficient producers, he said, and they needed to be eliminated. He did not say, indeed, there was no indication that he had ever considered what might be the limits of his criterion or his logic. Did he propose to applaud this process year after year until biggest and most efficient became synonymous with only? Did these dairymen have any value not subsumed under the headings of efficiency? And who benefited by their failure? Assuming that the benefit reached beyond the more efficient, that is, the bigger producers, to lower the cost of milk to consumers, do we then have a formula by which to determine how many consumer dollars are equal to the livelihood of one dairyman? Or is any degree of efficiency worth any cost? I do not think that this expert knows the answers. I do not think that he is under any pressure, scholarly, professional, moral, or otherwise, to ask the questions. This sort of regardlessness is invariably justified by pointing to the enormous productivity of American agriculture. But any abundance, in any amount, is illusory if it does not safeguard its producers. And in American agriculture, it is now virtually the accepted rule that the abundance will destroy its producers. And along with the rest of society, the established agriculture has shifted its emphasis and its interests from quality to quantity, having failed to see that in the long run, the two ideas are inseparable. To pursue quantity alone is to destroy those disciplines in the producer that are the only assurance of quantity. What is the effect on quantity of pursuing a producer to produce an inferior product? What, in other words, is the relation of pride or craftsmanship to abundance? That is another question the agribusinessmen and their academic collaborators do not ask. They do not ask it because they are afraid of the answer. The preserver of abundance is excellence. My point is that food is a cultural product. It cannot be produced by technology alone. Those agriculturists who think of the problems of food production solely in terms of technological innovation are oversimplifying both the practicalities of production and the network of meanings and values necessary to define, nurture, and preserve the practical motivations. That the discipline of agriculture should have been so divorced from other disciplines has its immediate cause in the compartmental structure of the universities, in which complementary, mutually sustaining, and enriching disciplines are divided, according to professions, into fragmented, one-eyed specialties. It is suggested, both by the organization of the universities and by the kind of thinking they foster, that farming shall be the responsibility only of the College of Agriculture, that law shall be in the sole charge of the professors of law, that morality shall be taken care of by the philosophy department, reading by the English department, and so on. The same, of course, is true of government, which has become another way of institutionalizing the same fragmentation. However, if we conceive of a culture as one body, which it is, we see that all of the disciplines are everybody's business, and that the proper university product is therefore not whittled down, isolated mentality of expertise, but a mind competent in all its concerns. To such a mind, it would be clear that there are agricultural disciplines that have nothing to do with crop production, just as there are agricultural obligations that belong to the people who are not farmers. A culture is not a collection of relics or ornaments, but a practical necessity, and its corruption invokes calamity. A healthy culture is a communal order of memory, insight, value, work, conviviality, reverence, aspiration. It reveals the human necessities and the human limits. It clarifies our inescapable bonds to the earth and to each other. It assures that the necessary restraints are observed, that the necessary work is done, and that it is done well. A healthy farm culture can be based only upon familiarity and can grow only among people soundly established upon the land. It nourishes and safeguards a human intelligence of the earth that no amount of technology can satisfactorily replace. The growth of such a culture was once a strong possibility in the farm communities of this country. We now have only the sad remnants of those communities. If we allow another generation to pass without doing what is necessary to enhance and embolden the possibility now perishing with them, we will lose it altogether. And then we will not only invoke calamity, we will deserve it. Several years ago, I argued with a friend of mine that we might make money by marketing some inferior lambs. My friend thought for a minute, and then he said, "I'm in the business of producing good lambs, and I'm not going to sell any other kind." He also said that he kept the weeds out of his crops for the same reason that he washed his face. The human race has survived by that attitude. It can survive only by that attitude, though the farmers who have it have not been much acknowledged or much rewarded. Such an attitude does not come from technique or technology, does not come from education. In more than two decades in universities, I've rarely seen it. It does not come even from principle. It comes from a passion that is culturally prepared, a passion for excellence and order that is handed down to young people by older people whom they respect and love. When we destroy the possibility of that succession, we will have gone far toward destroying ourselves. It is by the measure of culture rather than economics or technology that we can begin to reckon the nature and cost of the country-to-city migration that has left our farmland in the hands of only 5% of the people. From a cultural point of view, the movement from farm to city involves a radical simplification of mind and character. A competent farmer is his own boss. He has learned the disciplines necessary to go ahead on his own, as required by economic obligation, loyalty to his place, pride in his work. His workdays require the use of long experience and practiced judgment, for the failures of which he knows that he will suffer. His days do not begin and end by rule, but in response to necessity, interest, and obligation. They are not measured by a clock, but by the task and his endurance. They last as long as necessary, or as long as he can work. He has mastered intricate formal patterns in ordering his work within the overlapping cycles, human and natural, controllable and uncontrollable, of life on a farm. Such a man, upon moving to the city and taking the job in an industry, becomes a specialized subordinate, dependent upon the authority and judgment of other people. His disciplines are no longer implicit in his own experience, assumptions, and values, but are imposed on him from the outside. For a complex responsibility, he has substituted a simple dutifulness. The strict competencies of independence, the formal mastery, the complexities of attitude and know-how necessary to life on the farm, which have been in the making in the race of farmers since before history, are all replaced by the knowledge of some fragmentary task that might be learned by rote. Such a simplification of mind is easy, given the pressure of economics and social fashion that has been behind it, and the decline of values that has accompanied it. It may be said to have been gravity-powered. A reverse movement is necessary, and some have undertaken it, is uphill, and it is difficult. It cannot be fully accomplished in a generation. It will probably require several generations, enough to establish complex local cultures with strong communal memories and traditions of care. There seems to be a rule that we can simplify our minds and our culture only at the cost of an oppressive social and mechanical complexity. We can simplify our society, that is, make ourselves free, only by undertaking tasks of great mental and cultural complexity. Farming, the best farming, is a task that calls for this sort of complexity, both in the character of the farmer and in his culture. To simplify either one is to destroy it. That is because the best farming requires a farmer, a husbandman, a nurturer, not a technician or a businessman. A technician or a businessman, given the necessary abilities and ambitions, can be made in a little while by training. A good farmer, on the other hand, is a cultural product. He is made by a sort of training, certainly in what his time imposes or demands, but he is also made by generations of experience. This essential experience can only be accumulated, tested, preserved, handed down in settled households, friendships, and communities that are deliberately and carefully native to their own ground, in which the past has prepared the present and the present safeguards the future. The concentration of the farmland into larger and larger holdings and fewer hands, with the consequent increase of overhead debt and dependence on machines, is thus a matter of complex significance, and its agricultural significance cannot be disentangled from its cultural significance. It forces a profound revolution on the farmer's mind. Once his investment in land and machines is large enough, he must forsake the values of husbandry and assume those of finance and technology. Henceforth, his thinking is not determined by agricultural responsibility, but by financial accountability and the capacities of his machines. Where his money comes from becomes less important to him than where it is going. He is caught up in the drift of energy and interest away from the land. Production begins to override maintenance. The economy of money has infiltrated and subverted the economics of nature, energy, and the human spirit. The man himself has become a consumptive machine. For some time now, ecologists have been documenting the principle that you can't do one thing, which means that in a natural system, whatever affects one thing ultimately affects everything. Everything in the creation is related to everything else and dependent on everything else. The creation is one. It is a universe, a whole, the parts of which are turned into one. A good agricultural system, which is to say a durable one, is similarly unified. In the 1940s, a great British agricultural scientist, Sir Albert Howard, published An Agricultural Testament and the Soil and Health, in which he argued against the influence in agriculture of the laboratory hermit, who had substituted that dreary principle, official organization, for the soul-shaking principle of that essential freedom needed by the seeker after truth. And Howard goes on to speak of the disruptiveness of official organization. The natural universe, which is one, has been halved, quartered, fractioned. Real organization always involves real responsibility. The official organization of research tries to retain power and avoid responsibility by sheltering behind groups of experts. Howard himself began as a laboratory hermit. I could not take my own advice before offering it to other people. But he saw the significance of the wide chasm between science in the laboratory and practice in the field. He devoted his life to bridging that chasm. He is the story of a fragmentary intelligence seeking both its own wholeness and that of the world. The aim that he finally realized in his books was to prepare the way for treating the whole problem of health in soil, plant, animal, and man as one great subject. He unspecialized his vision, in other words, so as to see the necessary unity of the concerns of agriculture as well as the convergence of these concerns with the concerns of other kinds, biological, historical, medical, moral, and so on. He sought to establish agriculture upon the same unifying cycle that preserves health, fertility, and renewal in nature, the wheel of life, as he called it, borrowing the term from religion, by which death supersedes life and life rises again from what is dead and decayed. It remains only to say what has often been said before, that the best human cultures also have this unity. Their concerns and enterprises are not fragmented, scattered out, at variance or in contention with one another. The people and their work and their country are members of each other and of the culture. If a culture is to hope for any considerable longevity, then the relationships within it must, in recognition of their interdependence, be predominantly cooperative rather than competitive. A people cannot live long at each other's expense or at the expense of their cultural birthright, just as an agriculture cannot live long at the expense of its soil or its workforce. And just as in a natural system, the competitions among species must be limited if all are to survive. In any of these systems, cultural or natural, when a species or a group exceeds the principle of usufruct, literally the use of the fruit, it puts itself in danger. Then, to use an economic metaphor, it is living off the principle rather than the interest. It has broken out of the system of nurture and has become exploitative. It is destroying what gave it life and what it depends upon to live. In all of these systems, a fundamental principle must be the production of the source, the seed, the food of species, the soil, the breeding stock, the old and the wise, the keepers of memories, the records. And just as competition must be strictly curbed within these systems, it must be strictly curbed among them, and agriculture cannot survive long at the expense of the natural systems that support it and that provide it with models. A culture cannot survive long at the expense of either its agricultural or its natural sources. To live at the expense of the source of life is obviously suicidal. Though we have no choice but to live at the expense of other life, it is necessary to recognize the limits and dangers involved. Past a certain point in a unified system, other life is our own. The definitive relationships in the universe are thus not competitive but interdependent. And from the human point of view, they are analogical. We can build one system only within another. We can have agriculture only within nature, and culture only within agriculture. At certain critical points, these systems have to confirm with one another or destroy one another. Under the discipline of unity, knowledge and morality come together. No longer can we have that paltry, objective knowledge so prized by the academic specialists. To know anything at all becomes a moral predicament. Aware that there is no such thing as a specialist, or even an entirely limitable or controllable effect, one becomes responsible for judgments as well as facts. Aware that, as an agricultural scientist, he had one great subject, Sir Albert Howard, could no longer ask, "What can I do with what I know?" without at the same time asking, "How can I be responsible for what I know?" And it is within the unity that we see the hideousness and destructiveness of the fragmentary. The kind of mind, for example, that can introduce a production machine to increase efficiency without troubling about its effects on workers, on the product, and on the consumers. That can accept and even applaud the obsolescence of a small farm and not hesitate over the possible political and cultural effects. That can recommend continuous tillage of huge monocultures with massive use of chemicals and no animal manure or humus, and worry not at all about the deterioration or loss of soil. For cultural patterns of responsible cooperation, we have substituted this moral ignorance, which is the etiquette of agricultural progress.
Now, from one great cultural critic to another, we return to John Taylor Gatto's reflections on his boyhood in Monongahela.
I hung around a lot in Monongahela, looking at things and people, trying them on for size. Much is learned by being lazy. I learned to fish that way, to defend myself, to take risks by going down in the abandoned coal mine, across the river full of strange machinery and black water, a primitive world with nobody around me to tell me to be careful. I learned to take knocks without running away, to watch hard men and women reveal themselves through their choices. I cleaned Pappy's printing office daily, after closing, for a silver St. Gordon's Walking Goddess Liberty 50-cent piece, the most beautiful American coin ever made. I sold Sun Telegraphs and Post Gazettes on the corner of 2nd and Main for a profit of a penny a paper. I had a Kool-Aid stand on Main and 4th on hot summer days. Shouldn't you ask why your boy or girl needs to know anything about Iraq or about computer language before they can tell you the name of every tree, plant, and bird outside your window? What will happen to them with their high standardized test scores when they discover they can't fry an egg, sew a button, join things, build a house, sail a boat, ride a horse, gut a fish, pound a nail, or bring forth life and nurture it? Do you believe having those things done for you is the same? You fool, then. Why do you cooperate in the game of compulsion schooling when it makes children useless to themselves as adults, hardly able to tie their own shoes? I learned to enjoy my own company in Monongahela, to feel at ease with anyone, to put my trust in personal qualities rather than statistical gradations. Anything else? Well, I learned to love there. Just across the river bridge and over the river hill was open farm country, and anyone could walk there in 30 minutes. Everyone was welcome, kids included. The farmers never complained. Mother would walk Joni and me there in the early morning as mist was rising from the river. When she was 72, I wrote to her trying to explain what I'm trying to explain now, how her town had given me underpinnings to erect a life upon. Dear Mum, I think what finally straightened me out was the memory of those early morning walks you used to take me up River Hill, with mist rising from the green river and trees, the open pits of abandoned coal mines producing their own kind of strange beauty in the soft silence of the new day, coming out of the grit and rust of Monongahela, crossing the clean architecture of the old bridge with its dizzy view to the river below, through the wide-set slats underfoot. That was a worthy introduction to the hills on the far shore. Going up those hills with you, we startled many a rabbit to flight. I know you remember that, too. I was amazed that wild things lived so close to the town. Then at the top, we could see Monongahela in the valley the way birds must, but when we turned away, everything was barns and cornland. You gave me our town. It was the best gift. My best teachers in Monongahela were Frank Pitsiga, the high-rolling car dealer, old Mr. Marcus, the druggist wiser than a doctor, Binks McGregor, psychological haberdasher, and Bill Pulaski, the fun-loving mayor. All would understand my belief that we need to be hiring different kinds of people to teach us, people who've proven themselves in life by bearing its pain like free spirits. Nobody should be allowed to teach until they get to be 40 years old. No one should be allowed anywhere near kids without having known grief, challenge, success, failure, and sadness. We ought to be asking men and women who've raised families to teach, older men and women, who know the way things are and why. Millions of retired people would make fine teachers. College degrees aren't a good way to hire anybody to do anything. Getting to teach should be a reward for proving over a long stretch of time that you understand and have command of your mind and heart. And you should have to live near the school where you teach. I had some eccentric teachers in Monongahela, but there was not a single one didn't live close to me as a neighbour. All existed as characters with a history profiled in 100 informal mental libraries, like the library of her neighbours my grandmother kept. On the way up to Third Street Hill to Waverley School each morning to discover what song Mrs. Whibble was going to have kids memorise that day, I would pass a shack made of age-blackened hemlock, the kind you see on old barns long gone in disrepair. This shack, perched at the edge of an otherwise empty double lot, grown wild in burdock, wild hollyhock, and briar. I knew the old woman who lived there as Moll Minor, because the boys tormented her by shouting that name as they passed in daily procession, headed for school. I never actually saw her until one Saturday morning when, for want of anything better to do, I went to shoot birds. I had a Red Ryder BB rifle. Moll Minor's lot had birds, and so, lying on my belly as if birds were wild Indians, I shot one. As it flopped around, dying, the old woman ran shrieking from her shack to the fallen bird, raised it to bosom, and then fled, shouting, "I know who you are! You're the printer's boy! Why did you kill it? What harm did it do to you?" Then, overcome with sobs, she disappeared back into her shack, her wild white hair and old cotton house dress, light grey with faded pink roses, lingered in my vision after I went home. Who could answer such a question at 8 or 28? But being asked made me ask it of myself. I killed because I wanted to. I killed for fun. Who cared about birds? There were plenty of birds. But then, what did it mean, this crazy old lady taking the downed bird into her home? She said she knew me. How was that possible? It was all very puzzling. I found myself hoping the BB hadn't really killed the bird, but only shocked it. I felt stupid and tried to put the incident out of my mind. A week or so later, I got rid of my BB gun, trading it for an entrenching tool and some marbles. I told myself I was tired of it. It wasn't a real gun anyway. Around Halloween, some kids were planning a prank on the old lady. I protested, saying we should pick on someone who could fight back and chase us. "We shouldn't pick on weak people," I said. "Anyway, that lady's not crazy. She's very kind." That winter, without asking, I shoveled snow around her house. It was a business I usually did for pocket money, and I was good at it, but I didn't even ask permission. I just shoveled the sidewalk without asking for money. She watched me from her window without saying a word. Whether she recognized I was the boy who shot the bird, I wish I could tell you, but that's all there is. Not a sparrow falls, they say. That was the way I learnt to care about moral values in Monongahela, by rubbing shoulders with men and women who cared about things other than what money bought. Were they cared about money too? I watched them. They talked to me. Have you noticed nobody talks to children in schools? I mean, nobody. All verbal exchanges in school are instrumental. Person-to-person stuff is contrary to policy. That's why popular teachers are disliked and fired. They talk to kids. It's unacceptable.